listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. At a time of unprecedented consensus approaching unanimity among the media, present and former senior officials of U.S. intelligence agencies, Democratic Party politicians and operatives, and establishment Republican politicians and operatives, particularly on the question of the Trump administration's foreign policy, we discuss the possible motive driving all of this with Professor Tony Montero. We spoke with him via Skype from Philadelphia on Thursday.
I think that we have been discussing possible motives for this for at least 2 years now, because if you remember, the call for impeachment began right after the election of 2016. And the ongoing process of criminalizing him and his presidency has been going on since he was elected. And this is even before there was any Mueller investigation. Right. Mueller is merely the institutional expression of the political objectives of the forces who lost the election, and larger than that, the forces who are politically and financially and in other ways connected to the maintenance of this huge American empire and the military bases connected to it, almost 1,000 all around the world. And so Trump is, in fact, a subversive presidency to the interest of the order, both financial, economic, and military, that supports American hegemony. he represents, as we have said, and I don't think there's any question about it, imperial pullback.
Yep.
And certainly from the use of the military as the instrument to force nations to accept America's diktats. So I think that's what we're looking at. I don't think there's much of a question about it. Those who don't see this don't want to see it, but it is clear what this is about.
Yeah, I mean, you've characterized it for a couple of years now as imperial retreat. And, you know, when you hear a president or a national political figure recommend, who ends up becoming president for what it's worth, recommending that or demanding that, for example, the NATO countries start ponying up their share of NATO's budget, that the same thing happened with Japan and South Korea, that the military relationships, say, as described, maybe not as characterized with the terminology, but as described, go from one of occupation, say, in Japan or South Korea, to one of military alliance with their national militaries, which are to be funded and, you know, grown to the task. You're talking about imperial retreat. You're talking about a multipolar construct instead of an imperial construct centered in Washington. And you've been saying that for 2 years. Now, this article that you pointed me to yesterday, the day before yesterday in the Washington Times, this is a direct quote. President Trump says he wants to bring U.S. troops home from Syria, the Korean Peninsula, Europe, and elsewhere, and unload part of America's military burden onto other nations, defense insiders and experts say.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's it. I think that explains much of what is going on. And of course, you know, his almost immediately after he is sworn in 2017, he withdraws from the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right, that's right.
And that's right. Immediately, not long after that, I should say, he re-engages, in particular, Mexico to renegotiate NAFTA. NAFTA agreement. And, of course, this week, I think it was on Tuesday, the leaders of the AFL-CIO, the United Steelworkers, the Teamsters, the United Automobile Workers, the International Association of Machinists, and probably other unions representing the industrial unions of the nation, met with Trump at the White House concerning the renegotiation of the NAFTA agreement. Now, for almost going on close to 30 years, the labor movement has opposed NAFTA and have gotten nowhere with Republican or Democratic administrations in a renegotiation to protect the industrial workforce of the United States against this flight of capital to Mexico and other places. Right. But now, with Trump, there is movement on this that favors the labor movement. And then you add to this the negotiations now going on between China and the United States in Washington over resetting the trade relationships between the two nations. And from everything that I am hearing, these are quite positive and productive relationships. Then you add to that the meeting between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump in Singapore. One of the effects or outcomes of that has been the movement towards economic integration between North and South Korea, as well as the demilitarization of the two nations, which is very, very positive. And then you add to that Trump's position in allowing Europe and the EU to determine its own relationships with Russia, separate from the big stick of NATO and the American military forces in Europe, has led to this important meeting between Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin last week. And the meeting discussed everything from Syria, and on Syria, the repatriation of Syrian immigrants in Germany, and I would imagine other parts of Europe, back to Syria, and economic aid to help Syria rebuild from the war that went on there. And then you add to that the discussions in Europe about Europe taking on responsibility for its own defense, which means that without the United States in Europe, Europe will move towards détente with Russia. And there will be, I think, a demilitarization and hopefully a denuclearization of the Eurasian sphere. I am of the opinion, Don, that it might not appear in the language and the way it would make us feel comfortable, but what we see objectively occurring in the Trump administration is, as you initially put it, the acceptance of a bipolar world, the movement away, and this is not, you know, just a pretty process, because you're dealing with the institutional power of the Pentagon and the military and its supporters, who are the majority of both the Senate and House.
Right.
It's not a pretty process, but what we see is Trump's position that the world will be a place not of military confrontation, but of economic competition, which means détente with Russia, détente on the Korean Peninsula, détente with China. This is very, very important. And I think if there is a slow-moving coup d'etat, and I think there is, I think the cause of it, the reason for it, is Trump's moving back from the old military policy of the American empire.
Yeah, we've got two particular areas that we see this, that have been, you know, for the last six presidents, I'd say, at least since Carter hired Brzezinski, we've had, you know, been pursuing a turnaround on detente, and that's what happened when they started with, you know, Jackson, you know, all of the things that started coming into real form, the solidarity movement, quote unquote, in Poland, and that the manipulation of the loans that had been made through the IMF and others to try to take down the Polish government, you know, these different things began with Brzezinski, and they've been policy. So, in other words, turning around the policy of détente was one thing that's been happening since Carter, and then turning back on what was called the Vietnam syndrome, which was basically, after Vietnam, a rejection of U.S. interference, overt military interference in the internal affairs of other countries, that, based in the reality that had just been driven home, that there were limits to what the U.S. could impose militarily on other nations. That lasted, like, perhaps most of Gerald Ford's presidency and about 2 weeks into Carter's, and then when he brought Brzezinski in, that became the turnaround point. This is the first time anyone's repudiated that. And, you know, not for nothing, the intervening period included the collapse of the Soviet Union, and yet this policy continued to be pursued. So now here's the thing. We're looking at a slow-moving coup. The rest of the world knows exactly what this stuff is about, particularly Russia and China. And what we have to do is ask ourselves, what are these other nations, Russia and China in particular, going to see in terms of their own security needs if they find themselves in a world where the U.S. military is under control of a government installed through a coup?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Yeah, that, and if that's a nightmare scenario, and if that is what all of this eventuates in. Not only does it create a more dangerous situation for the world, but the overturning of the 2016 election by a coup d'etat, in effect, might be the beginning of the end of bourgeois democracy in the United States. And it is not Trump, and this is the irony of it all.
I know.
It is not Trump that is the threat to democracy. It is his opponents who are the threat to democracy.
Right.
I don't know how to say it more clearly, but I think we have to say it over and over and over again. Like Trump or not, agree or disagree with policies, especially in the domestic field or his rhetoric, that is not the issue. The issue is that the threat to democracy is from the opponents of Trump and not from Trump. And that threat to democracy most immediately expresses itself as an all-out effort to reverse the 2016 election. This is not to be taken lightly, and it is Orwellian, because everything is the opposite of what the dominant forces in the ruling class are saying. It is the opposite. What they accuse Trump of, it is they who are guilty of it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, one of the things that befuddles people is the, I would say, inadequacy, perhaps, of the terminology, certainly the contradictions that are nested within the use of this political terminology, starting with the word, the D word, democracy. You know, we wouldn't be facing this particular assault on the office of the presidency were it not Trump or someone challenging these particular, you know, holy of holies, NATO, etc., that Trump has been doing. If Hillary Clinton were elected, there'd be no crisis, there'd be no questioning the legality of the election and whether or not it was a democratic expression. In our system, we have voter caging, voter suppression, negation, racism, the stupid anti-democratic electoral college, machines that cheat, all these different things. In other words, the idea that there has been a democracy, and you can go back to 1790 or 1789 even to test it, is laughable. But what they term, and what political scientists call bourgeois democracy, with the United States as one of the leading models of it, comes with all of those warts. And with all of those warts, Trump won. Whether he bribed some hooker to keep her mouth shut illegally, this, that, or the other thing, he won. And the effort to remove him is a rejection of the whole of the previous constitutional order, no matter how it's presented. And that means to people in Russia and China that are military planners, that these guys that have been aiming their weapons at us since World War II and that have been wargaming us in earnest since 2014 have now abandoned their own political traditions because something is coming up imminently that's so big that they don't even want to waste a moment on that stuff. And so how are they going to read it?
Yeah. No, in fact, in spite of the trade war, and I put quotes around that, between China and the United States, and and really the Trump administration's attempt to renegotiate the trade and economic relations between China and the United States. And the Chinese are not necessarily hostile towards it.
Right.
And all of these gestures
of
tariffs
and
so on.
Yeah,
it's a dance. Yeah. The fact of the matter is that that China is prepared to be treated by the United States, not as an emerging market, but as a major economic power in the world. So
right.
we have this resetting of the geo-economic situation.
Right.
I don't think Mexico is against it in the renegotiating of NAFTA.
Right.
And China is not against renegotiating its economic relationships with the United States, recognizing that Trump's policy, whether his way of doing it will be successful, is the reindustrialization of the United States
right.
and the getting of the American working class out of this 50-year decline in the
yeah.
standard of living.
That's right.
And that's what he's doing. And everybody recognizes that. They understand that this is the exercise of sovereignty, but they also realize that from the U.S. standpoint, this president is saying that the terms of the WTO and the global financial system that serves Wall Street and the big banks in the United States and Europe is coming to an end.
Right.
That is what Trump is trying to do. But, you know, I'd like to take a step back. Since there are those who argue about how much they miss Barack Obama because they don't like Trump's style. Well, let's look at things. And we're, of course, this is hypothetical, but I think there's some logic to it. Take the invasion of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi.
Mm.
That was under Obama. Do you think Trump, based upon what we know now, that Trump would have done that? I don't think so.
No.
Take the overthrow, the coup d'etat in the Ukraine, and the installation of what is a far right, if not fascist, regime. Do you think Trump would have been involved in that? I don't think so.
Right.
Take Syria. Would he have been involved in that? I don't think so. Let's go back to the Bush administration, the invasion of Iraq.
Right.
I don't think Trump would have pursued that policy.
Right.
Now, maybe you say that was 2003, that was 15 years ago. Mm. I'm saying knowing perhaps what he knows now and the conclusions that he drew from that, I think, one, he would be very critical of it. He would not have supported the invasion of Afghanistan.
Right.
I think, and I'll say it again, that Trump is the most peace, pro-peace president that we've had since John F. Kennedy.
Right. Now, I mean, this is what befuddles people, too. I've seen some of the responses that have been posted in various social media to that mm-hmm. assertion by you and by myself and others that, you know, that have mm-hmm. presented it. And, mm-hmm. you know, and it comes packaged with ridicule from people
yeah.
who, you know, think that the Obama presidency was a time of peace, that, you know, and point to his Nobel Peace Prize as part of the evidence. But, you know, the problem, the kernel of the truth of the statement is you're comparing him, of course, to the other American presidents. We've got Johnson and Nixon and Ford and Carter and Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush and Obama. Compared to them, that, which is the statement you're making, that's exactly true. These people, you know, Johnson started the Vietnam War, took millions of lives. Nixon mm-hmm. prosecuted the Vietnam War, probably took another million lives while he was doing mm-hmm. it. And also that coup in Chile is on his hands, and a whole lot of stuff mm-hmm. between the two of them happened in Africa with a lot of lives, I would say again, in the millions lost over that. Gerald Ford wasn't president long enough to really make a lot of trouble and mm-hmm. inherited detente from Nixon, mm-hmm. which is something that was achieved by in Nixon's time. Then Carter, mm-hmm. comes along with Brzezinski, who ultimately ends up taking down through the next two administrations the Warsaw Pact, but starts a war in Afghanistan that's still being fought today. So, you know, saying, guess what, we didn't learn the lesson of Vietnam. You think it was bad that that war went from 74 to from 54 to 74. We're going to start one now in 79 that's going to run till at least 2018. Okay, it's already like another 10 years longer than the Vietnam War. So he repudiates that. Reagan comes in with his boys. They're ready to start World War III. Bush starts the war in Iraq that continues until today.
Clinton and Afghanistan.
And continues that again. I'm talking Bush 1. He starts the war in Iraq in 1990, 1991. Then Clinton starts the first war in Europe since 1945, destroys Yugoslavia, by the way, blows up Somalia, a few other places, starves half a million kids to death and brags about it in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. Bush starts Iraq too and Afghanistan too. And so compared to those guys, what has Trump done that puts him in that class? Nothing.
That's true. And you know, the other thing is, I think we have to divide this period that you've outlined between the period of the Cold War when the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc exist, which was always kind of a stopper.
That's right.
A challenge to the global hegemonic ambitions or desires of American imperialism.
Right.
But the most dangerous period since the end of World War II begins with the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And this is when the idea of a unipolar world is put forward by the U.S. military and the politicians associated with it, where they openly say that this is a time of a single superpower. This becomes the most dangerous moment in world history since World War II. This has been close to a 30-year period. Now, Trump comes in, and by opposing the unipolar world and thus objectively supporting an imperialist pullback and saying, in effect, economic competition and military detente, if not military pullback, is the sine qua non of his global policies. This makes him certainly the most pro-peace candidate since the collapse of the Soviet Union. But I think for the reasons that you have given since John F. Kennedy. Now, for those who think that is a joke, that is something to be ridiculed, I want them to put forward the alternative logic and evidence to it, especially in light of the article on Monday in the Washington Times, which I think is reliable. I think it is a valid expression of what is going on, especially given what we know. Even if you take Iran with all of the bluster and the gestures towards belligerency that Trump has made towards Iran, let us not forget that he said, and I am prepared to meet with them anytime and anywhere. Have we seen that scenario before? Yes, with North Korea. I mean, look, I don't know how you can make a counter argument to it. Now, I know there are people who claim to be radical thinkers and revolutionaries and Marxists and all this, that, and the other, who will say, but this is a fight within the ruling class, and Trump is attempting to take down the CIA and the national security state in order to impose a total fascist regime in the United States.
Right.
My question to them is, what makes you think that we did not have a, quote, total fascist regime in place already,
right,
organized by the NSA, the CIA, and all of these 17 or how many intelligence agencies? It did not take a presidential election to do that. I think most people, but I think there's a shift going on. Most people that look at these things from whatever angle, from the angle of the deep state or the angle of the left, who look at these things seriously, recognize that what we are seeing is a profound movement away from this single superpower war, military hegemony policy, to multipolar world, military detente, military pullback, and economic competition.
You know, I can only reply and close with what Fukuyama said when he was asserting at the end of the Cold War, essentially that history had ended because mankind had reached the fulfillment of its ideological evolution, and that was the universalization of Western liberal democracy. In other words, we win. And a mere 28 years later, we're seeing its collapse. Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you so much,
John. That's all the news we have
for
you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. Is democratic socialism the future of the Democratic Party, the future of America? Is moving to the left a winning strategy to take on Donald Trump's vision of conservative populism? One thing is undeniable. Mainstream politics in both parties are under pressure to evolve and become more accountable. Crosstalking Democratic Socialism. I'm joined by my guest, Steve Malzberg in New York. He's a conservative political commentator. In Washington, we have Ivan Elin. He is a senior fellow at the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. And in Los Angeles, we cross to Ron Placone. He is a comedian. He's a frequent guest on The Jimmy Dore Show and The Young Turks, as well as host of his own streaming show, Get Your News On with Ron. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I always go to the person that got up earliest for the program, so that means it's you, Ron, in Los Angeles. God bless your soul.
thanks, Peter.
We hear a lot about the rise of democratic socialism, the turn to the left in the party, though the donors don't seem to want to go there. What is democratic socialism? Because I'd like to remind our viewers, I lived in communist Eastern Europe, and they called that democratic socialism, okay? And they didn't have a lot of Birkenstocks, and they didn't have a lot of cappuccinos, I'd like to point out. So, Ron, what is it in a nutshell? Go ahead.
Well, democratic socialism in the contemporary American sense. I mean, you know, whenever people throw around these terms, you need to factor in, you know, the snapshot in contemporary time. But democratic socialism is certainly not authoritarian socialism or anything like that. Democratic socialism, as the DSA is presenting it, basically just gives more rights to the workers. It still allows enterprise and stuff like that. However, workers have more rights and they have more of a say and they see more of the product. And what the DSA's mission is in particular is to try to get away from the economy that instead exploits workers and is focused on destroying the environment and war. They're trying to get away from all that to an economy that is more sustainable, that workers have a better seat at the table, and where everybody has health care.
Okay, Steve. I mean, socialism tends to become authoritarian if you don't keep an eye on it. I'd like to point out, and I'm living in a country that had a pretty disastrous experience with it. But Steve, you know, when I listen to a lot of people talking about democratic socialism, Ron pointed out workers' rights. I don't hear that so often when they talk. I hear about abolishing ICE, having open borders, cultural relativism. That's what I hear. I hear identity politics, and that makes the hair on the back of my head stand up. Go ahead.
Absolutely. All you have to do is go to the Democratic Socialists of America website and find out what the Democratic Socialists of America are really all about. Everything you just alluded to, plus guaranteed income, whether or not you're working. When you talk about the workers having more rights, they want the end of capitalism and workers to run the show. Workers would own and run everything. There wouldn't be private ownership by corporations. Stockholders would go to you know where. And let me just, if I may, I hate reading things, but this is very important. The disgraceful use of prisons to regulate behavior would be replaced with a system that decriminalizes a wide range of offenses and provides victims. Victims are the ones in prison. Provides victims with mental health care and various forms of counseling to help people find productive ways to move forward after committing serious crimes. So you commit a serious crime, no more prison, you'll get counseling. These people are loony bins.
Okay.
Please let the Democrats run on this, please.
Okay, Steve, what you just described was Gitmo in one form or another. Let me go to Ivan Elin in Washington here. I hate reading things too, but I will. A Harvard University published a study in April that found 51% of those between the ages of 18 and 29 dislike capitalism, with a majority preferring socialism as a political system. Is socialism a political system? That's what I'm worried about. When Ron talks about workers, I'm all ears. I'll listen to workers' rights. I don't have a problem with that, okay? We need a healthy left in the United States here. But people are talking about a political system that is socialism. Go ahead, Ivan.
Well, of course, the technical definition of socialism is nationalizing industry, nationalizing the means of production. And, you know, I'm not sure I hear anybody really talking about that. I see striking similarities between the right and the left that we have now. I wouldn't consider Trump a conservative. I would consider him a nationalist. He's been for quite a big government. If we want to talk big government in all its forms, I think, you know, he was he passed and the Republicans went right along with him, $300 billion budget, meanwhile cutting taxes and yawning the deficit and the debt. We also have him putting on tariffs, protectionist tariffs, which isn't conservative, and then bailing out the farmers with $12 billion worth of aid, which doesn't really cover the it's not going to cover the losses that he's cut off with tariffs. He's also said he's not going to do away with Social Security and Medicare. Now, my purpose here isn't to attack Trump. I'm just saying that he's a more nationalist Republican, and I think Bernie Sanders' followers have a lot in common with him to some extent. Now, of course, that's left populism, and he's sort of a right populist in the case of the president. So you're seeing the encroachment of big government, and you know we have all these terms for democratic socialism, right-wing populism, but we may end up sort of all at the same place with more government encroachment on our freedoms.
You know, Ron, it seems to me that, you know, in looking at some of the races, it's still a more of a rejection of the status quo, and some people move to the right and some people move to the left, but everybody seems to have a problem except for people in the center, and they want to keep everything the way it is. And I did mention just off the cuff, donors don't want a big change here too, and I'm not just attacking the Democrats here. You could easily, as Ivan did, do it to the Republicans as well. Go ahead, Ron.
Absolutely. First of all, We have border security. We had border security before ICE existed. It's not like anybody who calls for the abolishment of ICE is calling for open borders. I'm in favor of abolishing ICE. I think this country is a lot like espresso in that regard, better without ICE. However, that doesn't mean open borders. That just means a rejection of this organization that is being authoritarian and brutal. So that's the first point. And also, Yeah, the Democratic establishment is not a big fan of the DSA or anything they're about.
That's an understatement.
Their first priority, their first priority is stopping progressive policies from happening and pleasing the donors. Their priority further down the list is maybe beating a Republican, but that's not that big of a deal because whether that happens or not, the gravy train keeps a rolling. We are seeing a rise in populism. Now, I would make the argument, and I know some of you guys on this panel see things differently. That's fine. But I would say right-wing populism isn't really a thing. That's kind of an oxymoron. So I think Trump ran on this kind of idea of that. And a lot of people latched on to it. I would say largely he hasn't delivered on that, and I don't think he's going to. But I think that the time for true populism is at the forefront right now. And if history in the United States is any indication, we're kind of due for a sharp turn to the left right now. We're mirroring the Great Depression in many ways.
Okay, but
what happened after that was FDR.
Okay. Let me go to Steve here because, I mean, again, and Ron, you've been on this program before and we've discussed this, you know, left and progressive and the establishment and all that. That's fine. But Steve, you know, ever since 2010, the Democrats, have lost over and over and over again because they keep running on the same message over and over again. And one can make the argument that Trump appealed to the people that feel disaffected. I mean, a lot of white men, a lot of white people in general voted in 2016 because they finally found a candidate that they could see that would consider their concerns. OK, so, I mean, you know, a lot has been said here, but I mean, I do think that this is a lot about insurgency, and it's all about Bernie Sanders. I think this is going to be the most important event remembered, not that Trump was elected, but what was done to Bernie. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, first of all, let's also point out that Donald Trump got a higher percentage of Hispanics voting for than did Mitt Romney or John McCain, which I think is something goes overlooked and really shouldn't. Look. The reason why the donors don't want the Socialist Democrats' influence and policies and platforms is because they can't win. I mean, that's why someone like me is begging you and begging the Democrats to run
How
on these programs. Let the public know where you stand.
Keep going, Steve.
Because she lives in a little cocoon. First of all, a very small percentage of people voted, and she happens to live in a district where the message appeals. But even she is honest. When she is pressed on what she believes as a democratic socialist, she says, "Oh, I don't think we should have labels. I don't like labels." if the word got out that she was for abolishing prisons, abolishing capitalism,
she's not calling for not abolishing prisons. It's abolishing the for-profit prison industry. Those are two completely different things.
Oh, it's abolishing prisons.
Those are two completely different things. And if you want to talk about what's going on in private prisons, we could have a long conversation like that and how it's exploitative. Those are two completely different things.
Before the program, I said one thing: equal time for everyone. Ivan, let me turn to you. The GOP should love these Democratic Socialists because it's dividing the Democratic Party, and you can tell from the very top they're scared of these people. Go ahead, Ivan.
Yeah, I would say to the Democrats that, it's okay to have that wing of the party. I mean, the Republicans had the Tea Party wing, but it does make your candidates unelectable in certain places. Now, if the Democratic Party runs more conservative candidates in these places, they have a better chance of winning. But I'm sure the party apparatus doesn't really care for a lot of this talk about free college education for everybody, Medicare for all, because these are very expensive programs and nobody has figured out in the Democratic Party or anywhere else how to pay for these. But of course, you know, the Republicans have done this with their tax cuts. That's what they do to get elected.
Okay.
Meanwhile, they never cut spending and fed. Instead, they increase it.
I have to jump in and we have to go to a hard break. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on democratic socialism. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Ron here. again, I want to stress the issue of identity politics, because when I look at some of these things, I mean, Democratic Socialists of America, I mean, they've been around for a while, okay? And I looked at some of their older literature, and you're spot on. They looked at more at working people, getting a fair shake. That's fine. But what I see now is this infusion of identity politics, and I think that, you know, I can say pretty confidently, given election results over the last few years, that doesn't work. It doesn't work for the Democratic Party, but they don't, you know, when you talk about transgender toilets and stuff like that, it turns off the heartland. I'm from the heartland. This is something that people, they want the factories to start opening up again. They want their wages to go up. And then when you have these things, you know, this political correctness and these pronouns, all this nonsense, I don't have any patience for it because it doesn't advance my life or the people around me. How do you address that, Ron?
Well, there is a world of difference between exploiting identity politics for just political jargon nonsense and addressing issues affecting different communities. I would argue that the DSA is doing the latter. Who's doing the former? I would say that's what the Democratic establishment is doing. So I think a lot of the issues with identity politics, as in using it for wrong and dishonest means, I think that's something the Democratic establishment is doing. And there is, again, there's a world of difference between them and the DSA and movements like it. The Democratic establishment, they're the ones that like to point their fingers at people less powerful than them and say, oh, you didn't support Hillary Clinton. Well, clearly you're a sexist. You're not a big fan of Kamala Harris. Well, you're a sexist and a racist. That's where identity politics floats in a dishonest way. And there's a world of difference between that and addressing issues of different communities. One is a good thing. One, not so much.
Yeah, okay. Well, Steve, but I mean, Ron just proved our point. I mean, this identity politics, it's a dragon that eats its own tail. So obviously, Trump supporters are sexist and homophobic. But within the Democratic Party, if you didn't support Hillary, then you're just as bad as the Trump people. I mean, this is insanity.
Right. It's Hillary will tell you, if you're a woman, you listen, you didn't vote for her. That's because you were listening to your boss and your husband and your boyfriend, and you're not strong enough to stick up for your own beliefs. You were told who to vote for. Don't forget, half the country's a basket full of deplorables, and that's the mainstream Democratic Party. Look, again, I can't say this enough. When you look at free this, free that. By the way, let's look to Latin American countries. Let's look to Venezuela. What's the inflation rate there? 40,000%? I mean, please, I beg the Democratic Party, adopt the leftist ideals here, adopt the platforms here, adopt the ideas here. You'll never win another election. Never. It's impossible in this country. And the fact that they don't see that really calls into question what their goal is, because they're not dumb. They're not stupid people. They know they can't win generalized elections. And the good point made by Ron earlier, the Democrats are running conservative Democrats who are anti-Pelosi and to a point pro-Trump on issues to win districts. And you're talking about nationalizing democratic socialism? It doesn't make any sense.
Okay, but
how do you explain Bernie Sanders then?
Go ahead, Ron. Go ahead.
How do you explain Bernie Sanders? And I mean, Peter, you even said yourself, Bernie Sanders is the biggest story here.
Yeah.
How do you guys, if you think that it can't win? And I mean, we don't disagree on the corruption of the Democratic establishment. That's one thing where all of us will be in agreement. But how do you explain Bernie Sanders, a guy who is an open socialist, who came out of nowhere and almost pretty much caused a grassroots revolution, probably would have had the establishment not cheated him, is applauded in the heartland with a true populist message? How do you explain Bernie Sanders if you entertain the thesis that democratic socialism can't win?
Steve, you want to reply?
Because Bernie Sanders is a polished socialist. He doesn't talk about any of the other issues. All he talks about is income inequality. It's unfair, unfair, unfair. He doesn't get into specifics. He doesn't talk about the jails. He doesn't talk about the groups that you're talking about, transgender, etc. He focuses on one message and one message only, which resonates with a certain percentage of the population, a rather large percentage perhaps. But when push comes to shove, if you want to run as a democratic socialist or a socialist, and you have to own the other policies that go with it, and that will never fly.
Okay, let me get to Ivan in Washington. I mean, is this a pivot, a transformational moment? Because, you know, in many ways, you could see that Trump is the same thing for the GOP, because a lot of the purists in the GOP still hate Trump, okay? And also what we have here in the Democratic Party, you know, there is a huge split. I mean, I think all of us would agree that income inequality is a big problem, and that it's the single most important issue that can divide a society. We can always have these other issues on the side. Income inequality is dangerous here. Ivan Elin, is the Democratic Party really being able to address that issue?
Well, I think we have to. I think both parties have noticed the income inequality. Even some conservatives have started talking about it. But the problem is that the parties differ on the cause. Of course, the cause to the Democrats or the Democratic Socialists are, big corporations and, excessive profits for corporations and not giving it back to the worker. For the conservatives, it's that the very opposite. It's that the system has become so bogged down with regulations and other things and big government that the market is not allowed to, all the regulations create essentially oligopolies and that sort of thing, and that causes income inequality. So it just depends on which side of the fence you're on politically.
Okay. Well, you know, Ron, I mean, one of the things that was brought up to me here is that, this mantra, you know, with it, free this, free education, free welfare, free education for everyone. And they still want to have an open borders. I want to harp on the open borders thing because, I mean, this has been amplified over the last few months here. I mean, if you want to have a big welfare state, a super welfare state, don't you think you should have a border to make sure the rest of the world doesn't take advantage of it? I mean, then people on the inside the border are going to say, whoa, we want this for ourselves because we're paying for it, okay? So the open borders argument kind of deflates unless you want cheap labor. Go ahead, Ron.
Well, I mean, again, the abolishment of ICE and open borders are two different things. It's no one's calling for just complete nothing whatsoever. Everyone's calling for reasonable border security, at least to the extent that I see it. What people are against is the brutality of ICE. Secondly, it's not free stuff, quote unquote. What it is a reallocation of resources. We spend more on bombs in the military than pretty much the next 13 countries combined, just about. We have more than enough resources in this country to have a single-payer healthcare, nonprofit single-payer healthcare, which the community would pay for. It's not free stuff. It's a reallocation of resources of what we're already paying. We already pay a higher GDP for healthcare than most other countries, and we get less because of a broken for-profit system. Same with education. We could reallocate our resources to have tuition-free college in this country. We choose not to. Same with a Green New Deal or an infrastructure program. We have the resources to do all this stuff. But we don't allocate it that way. Instead, we just give bonus bomb money to the Trump administration or whoever's in power.
Okay.
Obama did the same stuff.
All right. Steve, education was mentioned, and that's another raw point for me. I think that all government expenditures except for maybe preschool and kindergarten should be cut, because all they do is teach an ideology, this nonsense, post-Marxist, post-structuralism, and it brings up people that into the world that can't do anything except for yell and scream about a perceived victimhood, okay? I mean, I was in the University of California system for a long time, and they don't teach you much. They just teach you to be angry and teach you to be a victim. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, look at what Attorney General Sessions said the other day, talking about the universities calling some of them out by name, they're raising a bunch of snowflakes. They have safe rooms and quiet rooms and places you can run to and you can't offend people, perceived offenses and blah, blah, blah. The whole thing is becoming a total joke. Look, again, all this talk of free stuff, at least I think Ron acknowledged, it's not free. Everybody pays for it. And it is a reallocation of funds. I mean, so to say that ICE is brutal is insane. To say that without ICE, you're not advocating open borders is insane. The public is already, the polls show they're dead against getting rid of ICE.
So we didn't have border security before ICE?
I'd like to know what limitations.
There was no border security before
ICE. We live in a different world, and I'd like to know who you would keep out. I'd like to know who you would keep out under what circumstances. I dare you to name what the circumstances would be and who you would keep out. Look, the public is, again, I'm a one-note pony today because the public would never go for these radical leftist ideals, proposals, policies. So please, somehow, let your candidates run on these policies and you will suffer worse defeats than you did under Obama, whose candidates all throughout the country, state, local, government, every level, got slaughtered in the elections. You lost over 1,000 seats overall in the nation. So you want to make it 2,000? Adopt these policies.
Okay, Ivan. Mm-hmm. You mean
Obama, the guy who ran on a center-left platform and won twice, didn't deliver on it, by the way, but
yeah,
ran
but
on
he,
it.
Yeah, but Ron, he didn't have coattails. Okay, and that's undeniable. Okay, Ivan. You know what we've just
in a
microcosm here. What we've seen on this program is not really a policy difference; it's a cultural difference, and I think that's what the election showed. And unfortunately, this cultural division, people are not talking to each other. We did a pretty good job on this program. Last 30 seconds go to you, Ivan Elin in Washington.
Well, I would just say, I think, you know, we need to stop the stereotypic yelling and talk about the issues. When we talk about all these expensive programs, the cut in the defense budget, the numbers just don't add up. I'm all for cutting the defense budget in half, but it's not going to pay for single-payer health care or free university education for everybody. We're $21 trillion in debt. We got $100 trillion in deficit, and I think both parties don't address those facts.
Okay, gentlemen, all I can say is to be continued. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, New York, and in Los Angeles. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.